accession number 19060, Reel 1.
Jim Murray, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in the northeast village of Kello, a little mining village, in 1933.
K-E-L-L-O-W?
K-E-L-L-O-E.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Kello?
Yes, I went to the local school and left it at the age of 15 with just a general education, no real qualifications.
So you left school in 48?
That's right.
And you spent the Second World War years in Kello?
Yes, I did.
What was it like living in Kello in the Second World War as a schoolboy?
Well, hardships with regard to foodstuffs and things like that. But with regard to bombing and that, we only had one bombing raid on the village itself, and I think that was a mistake. And otherwise, it was a pretty quiet time, really, except for the men leaving for the army and injured ones coming back. Other than that, it was quite a quiet time.
What do you remember about the bombing raid on Kello?
Well, I remember it. The planes were flying very, very low, and the sirens were going. People were scattering all over the place, and luckily, most of the bombs that dropped didn't explode, and they had to be dug out and dismantled. And one of them was actually emptied and used as a money box to fund the war effort.
Do you remember which streets or buildings they hit?
It was just the main street, and the ones that hit the main street didn't explode, and the ones that did hit the surrounding fields, so no damage was caused. We were quite lucky.
Did any fall near your house?
Within half a mile.
What was your address in Kello?
Three Brewery Buildings, Kello. My grandfather took this brewery, old brewery building, and converted it into a home. And we were a family of six. We were all born there.
Do you know which year this bombing raid might have taken place?
I think it could have been 40, 41, I would think.
What was it, an agricultural village or a mining
village? It was a mining village, but there was also a large limestone quarry which employed quite a number of people.
So was there no farming in the village?
Yes, there was farming also. That was one of my first jobs when I left school, was to work on a farm prior to going to the colliery, which paid a better wage.
So even though it was a farming village, you were still short of food?
We were still short of food. We were short of the things like tea and stuff of that nature, like sugar, fruit. But there was always potatoes, and there was always bread. Although bread was rationed, but there was always potatoes and bread, the mainstay stuff.
Did the war affect your schooling very much?
No, we carried on at school in much the same way. It didn't seem to affect it, except there was a fire and the whole school got burned down. And we had to carry on in the miners' welfare dance hall, where there was four classes in the dance hall floor, which that did affect us, where we were mixed up in each other's lessons, sort of thing, you know. Teachers talking over each other.
But the fire had nothing to do with the war as such?
As such, no, it hadn't.
What about the staffing of the school? Was that affected by war demands?
Yes, a lot of teachers went into the forces, And I can remember them coming back after the war. Some of them coming back and starting the school again after the war.
Any celebrations in the village at the end of the war?
Oh yes, we had all decorations out in the streets and all the tables out, laded with foodstuffs for a bit of a party with soft drinks and all that sort of thing. And it was welcome home, Harry, you know, whoever it was that was away from coming back sort of thing, you know, there's welcome home, John, and all this sort of thing. And we were, County Durham provided, I think, about 17 fighting battalions in the Second World War, a little county like that. And in the previous war, we provided 30-odd battalions, most of which were wiped out, by the way.
Now, when you left school, you said you did farming and pit work?
Yes, I liked farm work, but the money was tempting at the colliery where my friends were working. So I tried it there, much against my father's advice. And I left there, after a short while I left there again and went to work on a farm in Richmond, in Yorkshire, on a sheep farm.
What? Why had your father opposed you going down the pit?
Well, he was a Scottish farmer's son who was taught as an electrician up in Scotland. And as he travelled with this firm north and met my mother in this little village, he couldn't support the children that came along on electrician's wage. So he went down the mine and was coal cutting for 20-odd years. And at the age of 48, he had silicosis, pneumoconiosis, those pit diseases. And he always said to me to keep out and keep away from the stone dust and all that sort of thing. And it didn't take me long to realise that what he was saying was true. It wasn't a way of, it was a terrible hard life underground.
Did you leave because of the bad atmosphere you were breathing?
Not just that. I had a friend killed. A friend, 21-year-old, killed there. And then there's a 40-odd-year-old man killed the following week. And then I went for training at a neighbouring colliery at Ferry Hill. And I saw a pony get cut in half with a cable hauling tubs. And it snapped and cut this horse clean in half. And that was more or less what got me to leave the industry.
And how did you find the sheep farming in Yorkshire?
Oh, it was like going into a different world. I went to Darlington and met the boss who was selling a cow at the market. And he took me back to Richmond and then down the Swaledale Valley and then up onto the Feldham Moors. And the farm was called Cordilleras. When I checked up, I found out that it was a mountain range in South America, Cordilleras. And the farm was actually built on that sort of style, with lots of arches, although it was all moor stone work-like, you know. Yeah, and it was lovely. There was 2,000 sheep, and it was a 2,000-acre farm, 300 store cattle and hens and things of that, yeah, usual things you find on a farm.
So when was it that you went into the army?
Well, I had another move before that. This boss was going to shoot me with a shotgun one day and over something stupid. And I actually left him and went to work for his brother-in-law at Barnard Castle on a dairy farm there. And I was only there a year when I went back to the village again where I was born. And within the year, I joined the army. I was called up, because I went back onto a farm again, and I was called up for national service.
Which year was this?
This was 1951.
How did you feel about being called up?
Well, I quite looked forward to it, actually.
Why was that?
It was just an adventure, really. I thought I'd been away from home, and I'd enjoyed it. where I had been, and I thought, well, this is something new, and I actually look forward to it.
And where did you do the basic training?
At Bransforth, which was only about 10 miles from my home, Bransforth Castle.
What was that training like?
It was hard, and I was up. My dad was a boxer, and my brother was a boxer. Although I hadn't done much, I could look after myself. And one of the first things they did to me, and what did to their squad, they took us down to the boxing ring, the whole platoon, put us in the boxing ring, tied our right hands behind our backs, and put a glove on our left hand. And we could hit anyone. It's called milling. But I didn't tell them I was left-handed. So I was the winner. But that labelled me for the boxing team, and I was the welterweight boxing. I was always on the boxing team as a welterweight, first string welter. And I boxed until I was 28.
How much did you have to weigh for that?
10.7, which was there's quite a lot of 10.7s in the Durhams, because we were all about the same size. So which meant there was a lot of preliminary fights to do before you got where you had to be.
And how tall were you?
5'8½.
And did you cope with the basic training all right?
Oh yes, I was fit as a fiddle, with working outdoors and that. And I was always an energetic sort of person. And I coped, no bother at all, fit as a fiddle.
How did the people in charge of the basic training treat you?
Good, very good. Strict, very, very strict. As long as you toe the line, you're all right. Yeah, I quite enjoyed it.
Did you toe the line?
I toed the line.
And after the basic training?
After the basic training, we went to Germany for a few months, where I did a B3 sub-pioneers course, which is like an assault engineer. Mines, booby traps, demolitions, all in readiness for Korea.
What kind of training did you call that?
It was an assault pioneer. It's like with the Royal Engineers, we were taught all about booby traps and mines and trenches and all that sort of thing.
Can you give me any details of that kind of training?
Well, a lot of it was heavy and frightening in a way, because they used to instead of putting a charge on the end of the fuse, they just put a cracker, something that would make a noise. So you weren't allowed to see these things. You just had to feel for the booby trap. Once you found it, you had to recognise it by feel, and then you had to learn how to disarm it by feel. And if you weren't good enough, it exploded, and it might have blow a few stones into you, but it wouldn't cut you, but it would sting you. You know, the bang would frighten you more than it would hurt. That sort of thing. We did watermanship, river crossings and all that sort of thing. On the Havel in Berlin, the River Havel.
What did a typical booby trap look like then?
Well, I always remembered them, the switches. And I remembered them by the numbers. And it was 4, 5, 6, 9, pull, pressure, release, time. That was the four switches, the main switch. Now they've got all sorts of electronic switches and all that. So pull, so if pressure was, if a tripwire was stretched out and you caught the tripwire, that was the pull switch that would be working there, that would ignite the main charge. So there'd be a switch on the end of the switch, there'd be a 2-2 cap which would ignite a fuse and set off the charge. Or pressure, it was sort of a switch which would be under maybe a loose floorboard or somewhere like that. Or then there was pressure release, so that when the pressure was applied, it didn't go off. But when you went to move off again, pressure release released the switch which set off the charge. And then the time switch was a piece of lead rod which stretched under pressure. And it, in time, it got so thin, like a piece of chewing gum, it snapped. And those were the four simple switches that we had to learn. and remember.
So you were in Berlin about 52, were you?
In 52. It was about 3 months in 52.
How did the Berliners, the Germans, treat the British troops?
Well, at that time. We used to go out into the pubs and that, and we were accepted quite well. And we didn't get marks for money then. We used BAFs, which was the army money. And we're only on 28 shillings a week. And 11 shillings of that had to be sent home to Mum. And the rest was needed for buying boot polish and brass award, so there wasn't a lot of money. And so I signed on for an extra year to acquire an extra guinea a week. So from a national serviceman, I became a 3-year regular to get that extra. So I was getting £2.08, something like that, £2.08.
Did you come across the other powers in Berlin very much, like Americans, Russians and French?
Yes, we did the Brandenburg Gate. We were down at the Brandenburg Gate, and we used to be on nodding terms and chatting terms to the Russians that were there. We spanned our prison where Hess was. We used to take our turns guarding that with the French, the Americans and the Russians. We'd meet them as coming on or going off, whatever. We did the border patrols where we came in contact with the East Germans. The Russians seemed quite decent and talkative, or trying to talk, and would share a cigarette with the boys that smoked. But the East Germans seemed to be quite a different kettle of fish.
In what sense?
Well, very strict sort of thing, you know. They scowl at you, you know, and they just didn't want to know you sort of thing. But always peering, always using the binoculars to watch you.
What would the Russians try to chat to you about?
Most of them were couldn't speak much English anyhow, you know. But they would just say good day sort of thing, hello, and nine times out of ten it was our boys that would be giving them cigarettes. But there wasn't any close communication with them, because we weren't able to, we couldn't speak each other's language.
What were your conditions of life like in Berlin?
Well, it was, the grub was very basic, the accommodation was good, very good. The barracks were ex-German barracks, and the barracks were very good. The beds were good. Yes, it was, I had no complaints there. I quite enjoyed Berlin.
And the next thing?
We came home for a while, did some training on the Yorkshire Moors, and they sent us home for a fortnight's leave. And I think it was in August we set sail for Korea on the Empire Trooper.
How did you feel about going to Korea?
Well, there again, we were young boys and we didn't. It was a country I'd never heard of prior to the war. And as young boys, we thought, oh, another adventure. And most of us were, I wouldn't say looking forward to it, but we just accepted it as it came along.
And conditions on the voyage?
Oh, terrible. There must have been more than 3,000 troops on our boat, and we were down in E2 deck, which was, when you think of the alphabet, it's a long way down. And there were 3-tier beds, bunks, which and the smell of sweaty feet, and that was really terrible. So once we got into the Mediterranean, most of us slept on deck, providing you got off the deck at 5:30, which was the time when the sailors came around to scrub the decks down and hose them down. So if you, as long as you got off at 5:30, you were okay. But it was much more pleasant lying up on the top.
Did you do training or instruction?
Yes, we did training on that. We did training on board. We actually ran. We ran the full circuit of the boat so many times a morning. We did weapon training off the back of the boat, firing at a target we were dragging. We did all sorts of physical training and boxing. I fought three men in one day for the championship. And the first man, I knocked him out in two rounds. The second man, I broke his nose. And the third man, I broke his shoulder.
Broke his shoulder?
He slipped and broke his shoulder. And they went into sick bay. And we didn't get any cups like they do nowadays. All the fighting I've done, I never got any cups. They used to give us a nappy voucher worth a pound. And my £3 nappy vouchers for fighting three times was spent on them, getting them fags and sweets in the sick bay.
What condition were you in after three bouts?
I was untouched. I was left-handed, and I should have fought southpaw being left-handed, but my dad had taught us the other way. And I had a very strong left-hand punch, straight left, and I had a good strong left hook when I was in close. And providing they were just, I mean to say the worst people, I did get beat, but not in the DLI, I didn't. I never got beat in the DLI. But I got beat in the Cooney Police where I went later.
Any other memories from the trip?
Oh, yes. We, as I say, when we got to Aden, we actually... Yes, when we landed at Aden, they decided we'd have a route march. So we actually marched into the city, Crater City, I think it was called, and the local inhabitants just disappeared. And we just marched around in a long trail and came back and got on board. And by that time, the ship had refueled and restocked, and off we went again. And the next stop was Hong Kong. Was it Hong Kong? Hong Kong, yes. And
did you disembark at Hong Kong?
Yes, we disembarked there. We had I think we had a couple of days there. And we just got out into once we set sail again. We just got out into the South China Seas, and a typhoon blew up, and one of our props broke. And we were, big as the ship was, we got tossed about like a cork. And it carried on for 3 days, and we were blown hundreds of miles off our course. And everybody was sick. The galley stopped cooking. And everybody was occupying the toilets, being sick, till they couldn't be sick anymore. And the place was terrible. Everybody was battened down. They couldn't get out onto the decks. And once it blew itself out, We slowly limped into Busan, and we were glad to get off the thing.
What were your first impressions of Korea?
Well, the first impressions, I think most people had the same idea. It was you could smell the place from say 3 or 4 miles out. We could smell we were coming in, like farmyard smells and that sort of thing, and. The harbour was a real dingy sort of place, but there, marching down the quay, was the Black American Band, with all brass instruments playing, and supposed to welcome us to the country. And we jumped off to help. There was a party of us volunteered to get on the quay and help to unload all the gear, which we... then stacked onto a train that was standing there with wooden seats waiting to take us up to the front, or so we thought.
What company and platoon were you in at this time?
I was in the Salt Pioneers then. I was a Lance Corporal then. I'd been promoted to Lance Corporal in the Salt Pioneers, in S Company as it was called.
What was the train journey like?
It was a boring old journey, and it kept slowing down. There's little kids at the at the rail side, selling the odd little bits of foodstuff which we didn't buy, and quite a boring ride. And we were beginning to start thinking then where we were going then on that train journey up there. And but we didn't go straight in. We went to Britannia Camp, a place called Britannia Camp.
What did that consist of?
And that was a tented camp, which we were there just to like acclimatise ourselves, I think, and to train in the surrounding areas.
What kind of training?
Well, field training, field crafts and things of that nature. But we, being assault pioneers, didn't last there very long, because 10 of us were selected to go with the Australians right into the front line in a position, I think it was called Nei Chon. And we were each issued to a company, and we had to learn where the minefields were and where the minefield gaps were and all that sort of thing before the battalion came in. The battalion was going to relieve this first Australian regiment that was in there.
Were the minefields marked?
Our minefields were marked. They reckon there were some dicey ones, but the majority of them were marked. And they were supposed to be Commonwealth pattern laid, which is a special pattern for that type of minefield.
What kind of marking would the minefield have?
Just the red triangles on the barbed wire, which is a common one throughout the world, I would think.
What was this Commonwealth pattern?
It was usually a mixed minefield, which was an anti-tank mine with two pierces out from the anti-tank mine. There'd be anti-personnel mine, and then to the left two pierces of the anti-tank mine would be another anti-personnel. So there's like, and to the right there'd be another anti-personnel. So there'd be three anti-personnel per anti-tank, and it was in a they were laid in a dog leg fashion. There was no straight lines with the mines. There were dog legs with plenty of barbed wire on the home side, with dannet coil and stuff like that, but only a one-strand barbed wire fence at the other side.
What's the difference between barbed wire and dannet wire?
Dannet coil is that like big hoops of it that stretches out, like a concertina fashion. And the barbed wire fence is just a single strand, you know. So naturally, we wanted all the dannet coil and the concertina type stuff at the home side to protect our positions. But the other side was just a clear single fence, warning even the enemy, that the minefields were there. But it was a defensive thing. You couldn't get any mass attacks over that particular area.
So you were with Aussie troops who were showing you all this?
Yes, yeah, 1st Battalion Australian Regiment, yes.
What impression did they make on you?
Well, we liked them, but we found where we were tend to be young and uptight and inexperienced, they were bigger people than we were, and treat everything very casually, seemed to be very casual, and tended to be quite laid back. But good, at the same time, they were good soldiers. But most of the bunks, underground bunkers I went into with them, most of them had a crate of beer, acai beer, underneath the beds, which was more than the British soldier ever had, you know.
In what way were they more casual?
Well, the